Unless you are really old, there is a war that has been going on every day of your life between Coke and Pepsi. Coke began in 1886, and Pepsi marks its formal beginning in 1903. And the cola wars have been going on for now more than a century, with all kinds of promotions and advertising and new products that have come out in this war that Coke so far seems to be winning. In the worldwide market, Coca-Cola is about 10 percentage points ahead of Pepsi. In early 2006, an administrative assistant at the Coke headquarters in Atlanta sneaked out of the building some papers with secret confidential strategies and promotions that were upcoming from Coca-Cola, as well as, in her purse, she sneaked out a bottle of a new product that had not yet been announced. Then, with two other Coke employees, she wrote a letter to the executives at PepsiCo and offered to sell this information to them. That gave Pepsi an opportunity for a comparatively low price to gain an advance and secret competitive advantage over Coca-Cola. So, what should Pepsi do? Well, the Pepsi executives called the executives at Coke and told them what had happened, and the Coke executives called the FBI, and a sting operation was set up. So the administrative assistant from Coca-Cola, who thought that she was meeting somebody from Pepsi in order to get $1.5 million, instead met with an FBI agent and was arrested. And Dave DeSecco, the Pepsi spokesperson, said, "We were just doing what any responsible company would do." So, hooray for Pepsi. Buy a Pepsi today for Pepsi-Cola, because they did the right thing. Although you can't help but wonder if they were tempted to do the wrong thing, because we all are. That's why we pray in the Lord's Prayer, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." Okay, let's suppose that you are tempted to do something that is wrong and you make the right decision and you do what is right. Does that mean that you are inoculated so that you won't be tempted again? Is it sort of like the measles and the chicken pox or getting a vaccination that makes you exempt from further temptation? If you resist stealing or lying or adultery or gossip or murder, does that mean that you are home free and will never really seriously be tempted to do any of those things? Or is it possible that they will haunt you and come back again on another day? Let's ask David, because he knows it happened to him. We've been studying the Old Testament biography of David, and a couple of weeks ago, we read what I think is an interesting story from 1 Samuel chapter 24, where David had opportunity to kill King Saul. Saul was a madman who was bent on killing David. David had done everything pretty much right. I don't think he had done anything that really was wrong, but Saul was jealous of David's popularity, and he wanted him dead. So he pursued him, and David repeatedly escaped. But in one of those pursuits, Saul had the whole army, or at least 3,000 of their elite soldiers, out hunting for David. David hid in a cave, and of all people, Saul came into the cave in order to go to the bathroom in private. And David had an opportunity to kill him, but he didn't. It just wasn't right. So he resisted temptation and he let Saul live. David did the right thing. And King Saul knew that David was right and that he was wrong. He admitted to it, but he just kept hunting David to kill him anyway. It was a short time later that a similar opportunity came to David. Another chance to kill the man who wanted to kill him. This second round of temptation is recorded in the Bible in 1 Samuel chapter 26. So I invite you to your own Bible and invite you to open up to 1 Samuel 26. Or if you don't have your own Bible with you today, then pick up the blue Wooddale Bible in front of you, and it begins on page 462. The story goes like this. The Ziphites went to Saul at Gibeah and said, "Is not David hiding on the hill of Hakkelah, which faces Jeshimon?" So Saul went down to the desert of Ziph with his 3,000 chosen men of Israel to search there for David. Saul made his camp beside the road on the hill of Hakkelah facing Jeshimon, but David stayed in the desert. When he saw that Saul had followed him there, he sent out scouts and learned that Saul had definitely arrived. Then David set out and went to the place where Saul had camped. He saw where Saul and Abner, the son of Ner, who was the commander of the army, had lain down. Saul was lying inside the camp with the army encamped around him. Then David asked Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, "Who will go down into the camp with me to Saul?" "I'll go with you," said Abishai. So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. Abner and the soldiers were lying around him. Abishai said to David, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hands. Now let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of my spear. I won't strike him twice." So the Ziphites, they were part of the nation of Israel, and they were loyal to King Saul and anxious to help him catch David. And they were sort of like his CIA. They were the ones that delivered intelligence, and their spying reports said that David was hiding out in the southern desert part of the province of Judah. So Saul took his army, all 3,000 of them. Actually, that wasn't his entire army. That was just the carefully selected elite forces who were well-fed and well-trained and well-equipped and had lots of experience in previous battles. And it wasn't much of a match for David to compete with his 600 sort of riff-raff outcasts that had joined him to make up an army that was ill-fed and ill-equipped and not very experienced and certainly not very well-trained. Although they were starting to get organized, and some of them had been appointed to become scouts. And those scouts delivered intelligence information of their own, reporting the location of Saul's army to David. When he found out this information, David could have run. He probably should have run, but he didn't. He was fascinated by Saul. Saul had been his mentor. He had married Saul's daughter. Saul was the king of Israel, and Saul had an attraction to David. So David decided to check out the army, and he would go and sneak into the camp, tiptoe right to the center where was sleeping the man who had determined to kill him. Apparently, he was asleep in the middle of the camp, and then his officers were around him, and then the rest of the 3,000 of this select army were in circles around them. So that meant that he had essentially 3,000 bodyguards. And David and Abishai went right into the middle of this camp. If anyone heard them, if anyone saw them and raised an alarm, they were almost surely going to be quickly killed. But you can sense that David was excited to take this risk. His heart was pumping. The adrenaline was flowing because risk-taking can do that. You know, when you take a dangerous risk, it can be truly exciting. It can be addictive. And you begin to wonder if David, because he had always escaped his enemy, was starting to lose his wise judgment. Did he think that he was somehow invulnerable? Did he think that he could do anything and take any risk and always get away with it? And at least for this moment, you start to think of him as being like the teenager who just got a driver's license or not yet has a driver's license and takes the family car and drives it over 100 miles an hour right down Main Street. or the 20-something woman who says, sure, I can be promiscuous. Don't worry about me. I will never get an infection. Or the guy at the office who flirts with his female employees thinking, oh, come on, I know where to draw the line and I can stop it before an affair actually gets started. Or the bookkeeper or the executive who wants to spin the books in a way that is profitable personally but stealing from the company and says, ah, I'll never get caught. It just won't happen. So what should David do? There in the middle of the camp with an opportunity to kill his enemy. What would you do? Well, I know what the answer is for every one of us. I don't kill kings, so it's easy. I would just never do something like that. But we need to be cautious that we do not overestimate our own morality. For there are a lot of people who say that they would never do something that in fact they actually do end up doing. There are some studies that indicate that those who protest the most, insisting that they would never do some immoral act, may actually be among those who are particularly likely to fall into the temptation and to do that. So let us be careful to realize that none of us is exempt from any temptation or any evil. In fact, it may be easier to submit to a temptation the second or the third time around. Because the first time a temptation arises, we have an instinctive defense, an aversion that stops us immediately so we don't do it. But then after that, we have opportunity to think it through, to imagine what it would actually be like, to fantasize about how we will get away with submitting to that temptation. And so for some, the second or the third or the tenth time is actually a more vulnerable time than the first round with temptation because we've thought about it and our defenses are down and maybe we could do this after all. David didn't do it. Maybe he wanted to, but he resisted temptation. David said to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives," he said, "the Lord himself will strike him. Either his time will come and he will die, or he will go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now get the spear and water jug that are near his head and let's go." And we realize that David is starting to grow up. He's starting to mature. He's starting to increase in spiritual wisdom. And one of the ways that that shows is that he distinguished between the man and the office. Let there be no doubt, Saul was a jerk. Saul was an intended murderer. Saul was a misuser of power and authority. Saul was someone who forced David's wife, who loved David dearly, into another marriage with another man that she absolutely didn't want. He did despicable things, but he was still the king. He had been appointed and anointed by God. And therefore, David had to distinguish between Saul the man and the office which Saul held. And with respect, he had to be careful to protect the God-anointed king of Israel. And it is a choice that we too face. Because sometimes in our companies or in our offices or especially in our government, there are people who hold positions from some local official to the president of the United States of America. And we may disagree with that person's politics. We may have disdain for that person's personal behavior and morality. But we acknowledge that this is someone who holds an office that has been given by God. We remember the words in the New Testament in Romans chapter 13, that everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. So it was for David, and it is for us, a sign of wisdom and a sign of maturity to distinguish between the person and the office that that person holds. But there's another indication of David's growing in wisdom and maturity, and that is that he trusted God to deal with his enemy. He didn't have to do this. He didn't have to take someone else's life into his hands. If he needed to die, then God could strike him dead there right on the spot. Or God could set up the system where he would die in battle. Or if it was God's choice that he could die of natural causes, maybe of old age. But it wasn't David's choice. It wasn't David's right. It wasn't David's life to take. And that, too, is a choice that we frequently face, that we need to often deal with those who are our critics, our enemies, those with whom we disagree, and that we dare not play God, that we dare not take somebody else's life or even somebody else's reputation into our hands. A wise and a mature Christian understands that. That God can deal with others himself in his way and in his time, and that we don't have to attack. That we can leave even our enemies for God to deal with. So David resisted the temptation to destroy his enemy, but I will tell you that he did take full political advantage of what happened. So David took the spear and the water jug near Saul's head, and they left. No one saw or knew about it, nor did anyone wake up. They were all sleeping because the Lord had put them into a deep sleep. Then David crossed over to the other side and stood on top of the hill, some distance away. There was a wide space between them. He called out to the army, to Abner, son of Ner, "Aren't you going to answer me, Abner?" Abner replied, "Who are you who calls to the king?" David said, "You're a man, aren't you? And who is like you in Israel? Why didn't you guard your lord the king? Someone came to destroy your lord the king. What you have done is not good. As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men deserve to die because you did not guard your master, the Lord's anointed. Look around you. Where's the king's spear and water jug that were near his head?" So David was pretty clever. He was a smart politician. First of all, he got a great distance between him and the people that wanted to kill him so that he was out of range for them to grab him or to throw a spear. And then, once he got everybody awake and looking his direction, he held up a water bottle in one hand and a spear in the other hand that everybody quickly recognized had the king's identity written all over it. And he said, "Well, you know, where do you suppose that I got this? What do you think happened here?" And then he focused in on the commanding general of this Israelite army, and that was a man named Abner, and he undermined his authority. He said, "You know, you didn't do your job. You deserve to die. You at least ought to be demoted. You shouldn't be a general any longer because your primary job is to protect the king. And yet, we can walk right into camp and take his water jug and take his spear and walk right out of camp again. So what's the matter with you anyway?" And then, to add insult and irony to all of this, Abner was actually the first cousin of King Saul. So it was not just a political matter, it was a family matter as well. Now, most of this report is dialogue. But the historian that writes it down does add an editorial comment. It's in the end of 1 Samuel 26:12. "So David took the spear and the water jug near Saul's head, and they left. No one saw or knew about it, nor did anyone wake up. They were all sleeping because the Lord had put them into a deep sleep." Sort of sounds like a Northwest Airlines flight that's going right over Minneapolis and over into Wisconsin here. So the historian inserts this little part of the story that apparently God put some Tylenol PM in the water of the entire army before they went to bed that night, and God caused this deep snooze, and the historian is saying that God was behind all of this. It's interesting because some of us with some skepticism, may want to say here, "Whoa, that's not fair. God's getting involved, and God will just leave this alone and let it play out the way it needs to play out." Except this is precisely the kind of thing that we pray for. We pray and we say, "God, won't you please engage in what is happening in my life, in my family, in my community, in my country, in our world? God, make a difference. Change armies, change people, change circumstances." So what we have here is actually a dynamic that is something that we deal with continually. And that is that these characters in this story, they were responsible for their own moral behavior. But God was also engaged, and God was shaping the ultimate direction that everything would go. And so it is in our lives as well, that God holds us accountable and expects us to be responsible, that we behave morally and justly, that we do the right thing, but God is still engaged in the details of everything that is happening. Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" David replied, "Yes, it is, my lord the king." And he added, "Why is my lord still pursuing his servant? What have I done, and what wrong am I guilty of? Now let my lord the king listen to his servant's words. If the Lord has incited you against me, then may he accept an offering. If, however, men have done it, may they be cursed before the Lord. They have now driven me from my share in the Lord's inheritance and have said, 'Go serve some other gods.' Now, do not let my blood fall to the ground far from the presence of the Lord. The king of Israel has come out to look for a flea as one hunts a partridge in the mountains." And what David is here trying to do is talk some sense into this crazy king. And he offers him a compromise, a solution, a way out of the mess that they are in. And he does it by trying to put Saul's behavior into a larger context. He's saying that if God is behind the conflict between us, let's the two of us get together and offer a sacrifice to God so that this can stop. And if it's not a spiritual explanation, if it's the misbehavior of someone, and implied here it's the misbehavior of Saul the king, then whoever is misbehaving ought to be confronted. But one way or another, we ought to deal with it. Let's put all of this into perspective. And specifically, he's seeking to put into perspective that the king of Israel has come out to look for a flea. David's referring to himself. He's saying, Saul, you are the king. Act like a king. You're responsible for the lives of millions of people. There's a war going on with the nation of Philistia. You shouldn't be out looking for me. I'm a loyal subject. I'm somebody that you don't need to worry about. A friend of mine said to me that when he was growing up, his mother, whenever he would get worked up over something, would sit him down and say, "Now, what difference is this going to make in 100 years? Probably didn't make any difference in the kid either. But the point is that you need a perspective that is long-term here. Because so often, so many of us take something tiny that is just for the moment, and we blow it up to become something that it should never have been. There are couples that do that. They're ending their marriage because of some terrible fight, and they can't even remember what the fight was about. There are people that are in prison because they killed somebody over being cut off on a freeway, or over a television program, or a slice of pizza, over things that are absolutely nothing that they've made into something it never should have been. Now, it seemed to work. David seemed to get through to Saul, and he became rational for the moment. And he promised that it would never happen again, that he would never pursue him. But he had promised this lots of times. And he kept reverting to his old ways. And so David listened to him and returned his water bottle and spear and repeated his refusal to harm anyone who was anointed by God. And then they said their goodbyes. And Saul and David never saw each other again. These are the last words that they spoke. Then Saul said, "I have sinned. Come back, David, my son, because you considered my life precious today. I will not try to harm you again. Surely I have acted like a fool and have erred greatly." "Here is the king's spear," David answered. "Let one of your young men come over and get it. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and faithfulness. The Lord delivered you into my hands today, but I would not lay a hand on the king's anointed. As surely as I valued your life today, so may the Lord value my life and deliver me from all trouble." Then Saul said to David, "May you be blessed, my son. you will do great things and surely triumph. So David went on his way, and Saul returned home. David did what was right, even though he may have been tempted to do what was wrong. And he did what was right for righteousness' sake and for God's sake, not because of the guarantee that it would come out the way he wanted. It did not come out the way he wanted. He did what was right because it was right. There are many days in David's life where I could not vouch for him or what he did. But on this day, I can. On this day, he demonstrated a wisdom and a courage and a maturity. He did what was right regardless of the income. And whatever that outcome may be, he entrusted it to the Lord. You know, we have opportunity to do that in our modern times. I can pretty much promise you that the opportunity will come this week, or if not this week, next. That there will be some enemy that is out there to get you. And you can respond righteously. That there will be someone with whom you disagree. You can treat that person well. That you'll have the opportunity to speak ill of someone in government. But watch your tongue. Follow the example of David and the words of Jesus in Luke 6. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. God, may we use a measure that is full of forgiveness and grace, wisdom and courage. May we heed the words of Jesus and follow the example of David for Jesus' sake. Amen.